The editor of Closer magazine in France is defending her decision to publish topless pictures of the Duchess of Cambridge.
They're a young couple in love. She's a young woman who is topless, just like the ones who can be seen on all of the beaches of France and the world. These are pictures that are full of joy. The pictures are not degrading.
That was editor Laurence Peau, who insists the photos taken while William and Kate were on holiday aren't grotesque. Officials acting on behalf of the couple are consulting lawyers. Violent anti-Western protests are spreading across North Africa and the Middle East. There have been clashes in Tunisia, Kenya, Yemen and Iraq over an American film mocking the Prophet Muhammad. A judge has described remarks left on Facebook about the deaths of six British soldiers as disrespectful and inflammatory. A 20-year-old man has been found guilty of sending a grossly offensive communication. West Yorkshire's Chief Constable has apologised for suggesting the behaviour of Liverpool fans made policing at the Hillsborough disaster more difficult. Sir Norman Bettison worked for the South Yorkshire Force back in 1989. He says he didn't mean to besmirch Red supporters. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is the Green Party candidate for the Mayor of Bristol, Daniela Radice. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, fracking in the Mendips, a wonderful new source of local natural gas. Or a licence to poison Bristol's water supply. We hear from Zoe Smith from Hotwells, who's just been to court with two colleagues for trying to stop the frackers in their tracks before they get here. Plus, the latest from around the world with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and our Palestine update. A UN report this week says conditions in occupied Palestine are becoming impossible. We have the figures and talk to a local campaigner. And an extract from the Iranian channel Press TV, which is now banned in Britain too. Also, former Bristol MEP Richard Cotterill is explaining this week how NATO has been secretly bombing its own people since the 1980s. He's got a new book out on the topic. And a special this week with former US Airman turned author who believes he's unpicked the network of dark forces which has been blighting humanity for centuries. Well, we'll see. Ever since the dissolution in 1307 of the world's first international bankers and original crusaders, the Knights Templar, in fact, and Prince Charles doesn't come out smelling of roses. An exclusive interview with Tim Cohen. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20 with a lovely sunny weekend. Next week, highs of 16, plenty of sunshine this week, some cloudy spells and possible light rain too. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of December, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest and helping us review this week's news is the Green Party candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Daniela Radice. Hi, Daniela, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon.
Tell us why you were drawn to the Green Party rather than another party.
The Green Party is really where my heart is. I started off as a teenager being really into the natural world. Evolution is the idea that really inspired me. So underneath, I'm actually a scientist. I worked then in environmental management for quite a while, for waste industry, also in the rail industry. But I realised you can do certain amounts with advice, with people encouraging, but you need the rules there. You need people actually to make the rules to make any change happen.
Okay, tell us a bit about your background then, in the work you were doing in these areas like the railways, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I worked for the waste industry. I worked as a regulator for the Environment Agency, so I used to go around scrapyards in Bristol telling people to put their oil drums away and stuff like that. Then I went to work with a private waste management company called Cleanaway in London, which was absolutely amazing. They had the most mountains of rubbish, literally, outside London. I came to Bristol, worked in the rail industry all over the southwest, just looking at whatever was going on really environmentally. We did a lot of work with preserving protected species like the large blue butterfly and dormice. And
well, how can you
like
work
that
in the rail industry? So you're not collecting tickets, you're going around saying, oh, well, yeah, you know, this is a nice environment. How does that work?
Well, they do a lot of work that's not necessarily great for the environment. They needed someone to tell them where they should stop and what they could and couldn't do. So I was like a bit of an internal policeman.
Can you give us an example of something that was going on the railway land then that you said, hang on, you've got to stop this?
Yeah, for example, there's down in Somerset, there's a place, I can't quite remember the name off the top of my head, where there's an absolutely fantastic, really rare large blue butterfly site. And what, Castle Carey, that's where it is. And what happened was there was a landslip and they decided they had to kind of completely re-engineer the railway. But there are these really precious large blue butterflies there. So I had to get involved in the negotiations to sort out how we could engineer it and save the butterflies.
What does that mean, say, for example, doing the work at a certain time of year, which is less sensitive to these?
Exactly.
What's so special about these butterflies, anyway?
They're the rarest butterflies in the country, and they actually went extinct in this country and were reintroduced in the 1970s, have now re-spread out over the southwest. So they're actually quite a conservation success story. And that particular railway line is the best habitat for them in the whole of the country.
The trouble is, of course, a lot of this environmental stuff isn't necessarily good for the economy. I mean, what you're doing there is you're getting a company to spend money on sort of looking after a piece of ground, a piece of land, when actually, surely, it should be investing in what it's doing rather than bothering about these butterflies.
That's absolutely not what I'd say. actually, that creates a lot of money. Investing in regulation actually creates opportunities for people to come up with innovative ideas to save things. The natural world is a limited resource. If we destroy everything, it's not going to be there for the future. The economy and the environment are inextricably linked.
Okay. The Green Party is a bit of a marginal party, isn't it, though? It's not one of the big parties. You don't stand so much chance of getting elected, so you're taking a bit of a bet and joining them rather than, say, the Liberal Democrats or the Labour Party, or what's the other one called? The Conservatives, you know. So I mean, what made you decide to go for a small fringe party?
Well, the thing is, I believe in actually working from my heart, what I actually really believe in, and the Green Party comes across as embracing both social and environmental justice, which I think is equally important. You can't have one without the other. The Green Party is growing. The more we stand for election, the more the other parties have to pay attention to us. We've got two councillors in Bristol now. We've got an MP, Brighton Council. I know it's a long way to go, but we really have to be there making our voices heard. The more we get on the media, the more people actually hear our arguments.
I notice you've got a manifesto for the city, which I imagine has been pulled together by the various different parties in the city, because you've got, you know, as many constituencies, I suppose, as there are around. You talk about it as a working city, a green city, an inclusive city. Is there anything you'd like to highlight in there particularly? I mean, I notice you've got a section, for example, on the NHS, which is going through a lot of changes at the moment. What's your vision for the NHS in the city, which has got something like £1 billion annual budget that's spent?
Yeah, well, ideally, national Green Party policy is that the NHS should be devolved locally. We believe that all decisions should be devolved to as near a local level as possible. Our main argument relevant to this is that we think that power, that we don't agree with the centralisation of power that the mayor represents. We want to introduce the locally elected neighbourhood councils. These will work with all the different interest groups going on in an area, so we'll be able to get the health service feeding into the local councils, getting local people to vote locally on the things that are really important to them.
But, I mean, we already have that to a certain extent with the neighbourhood partnerships. Anyone can go along to these neighbourhood partnership meetings, but, you know, so why change that?
Well, they don't have that much power. They've only a small amount of budget devolved to them as a percentage of the whole council's budget, a minuscule amount. There's a huge possibility to devolve much more power locally and get the council working better at a local level. If local people, different parts of the council, can actually work together, they'll actually be much more productive.
Well, one thorny issue in here is this business of asylum seekers. You've got obviously quite a lot about that in here.
Yes.
Bristol as an inclusive city. Now, the trouble is, a lot of your potential voters see people who've come from abroad as actually taking away labour, taking away jobs from here in Britain.
Well, everyone knows that's a complete fallacy, that people who come from abroad often are the ones who create the most wealth. They're the ones who work very hard. I think it's a complete myth that people take jobs away from other people. I mean, I'm descended from asylum seekers on both sides of my family.
But I think most English people are, aren't they, back far enough?
Exactly.
But ultimately, I mean, we have seen a great lowering of pay and conditions, and we've also seen a big increase in migrant labour, haven't we?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the two are necessarily inextricably linked. Migrant labour's come from all over the world, but that's because we have these deregulated policies that have allowed the wages have gone low because of the companies, not because of the you can't blame the workers for low wages.
Okay, also, I mean, we had a very controversial policy, well, was it a year and a half ago, which is the selling off of green spaces. Lib Dems and Gary Hopkins championing that. I would imagine you've got some things you'd like to see done there.
We'd like to see all green spaces protected, simple as that.
Why?
Well, obviously, green spaces are pretty precious in our city. Cities are a mixture of really dense housing, denser areas, urban areas, and green spaces. And I mean, the thrill of living in a city is when you've got a really great mix of people, but you also need a bit of outdoor space to run around and get some fresh air. So you need to make sure that balance is right.
Okay. Also, I must remind people about my little City Slackers project, which I did a couple of months ago, which is going through a list of all of the councillors in the city to see who bothers to return phone calls and emails. And one thing I will say is that the Green Party, even though you've only got two councillors, seems to be a lot keener to reply to emails and phone calls than the other parties. The Conservatives came out bottom with only 36% of their elected members. Over a third of their elected members not returning my phone calls when I asked them if they wanted to come on the radio and discuss the week's news. The Lib Dems were next with 28% of their councillors, and the Labour group on 18%. Now the Greens, 100%, both of them return my phone calls. The thing is, you know, I try and be persistent, make a few calls and see if people are coming on. So what does that tell us about, I mean, obviously it's saying something quite positive about the Green Party's commitment to politics in the city.
Yes, definitely. We're really committed to getting out there, speaking to people. I mean, in Southfield, Tess has her surgeries on the street. She has every month, she has a street stall.
Who's that?
Tess Green, the Green Party councillor in Southfield. So people will just approach her, you know, and come up to her without having to make an appointment or anything like that. She's just there for people to come and visit.
Okay, so we've got two councillors. I mean, what's the prospects? Do you think that the Green Party is going to be getting another councillor next year in the local elections?
At least one.
But the trouble is, of course, that the local councillors are going to have less power after the mayor takes over.
They are, but we will still be there putting our voice in the council, and whatever we can do, we will do. That's, you know, by being green, we are raising those issues up the political agenda, which is where they need to be. They need to be at the top of the political agenda.
Well, I'm also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We hear yesterday, or even today in fact, Martin, the Federal Reserve is going to purchase $40 billion per month in bonds until the job market in the United States approves. Now, this is more money printing by Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve. Is this something that's a sensible, good plan or not?
Well, I mean, we've also seen Mario Draghi's big bazooka deployed on the euro, with the German Constitutional Court agreeing to the bailout through the ECB. I think what's happening here is we really are reaching desperation point, both in the US and in Europe.
But why is it desperation? Because all they're doing is printing money, isn't it? Why is that a desperate thing to do?
Because if I think back to my youth, the idea of anybody doing anything like this would have been regarded as completely out of order. But now, of course, we do it more and more, even though we previously thought that we weren't going to do any of it at all. And that's because the system is broke.
I mean, you have to laugh, don't you? Because they are buying these $40 billion per month in bonds in the US. But where are they getting the money to buy those bonds from?
They're just making the money up, which is what happens anyway. But they're giving it to the banks instead of giving it to the people. What should have been happening since Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008 is that governments should have been asserting their power over the markets and basically cutting them down to size. But we find ourselves 4 years later still chucking money at them. And the effect of quantitative easing is to raise asset prices, which actually increases the net wealth of the wealthy people, and the wealthiest get the most. And it forces up commodity prices like food and oil, which in fact basically cuts the income of the poorest. So it's a massive redistribution from the poor to the rich, and it's got nothing to do with the market at all. It's all being done indirectly by the government, because free market philosophy is dead. It's over, but it won't lie down.
Now, I see you nodding away there, Daniela. Can you give us your take on what's been going on with this euro crisis and how much it is likely or isn't likely to affect Britain?
Oh, that's quite tricky. I mean, I think we are inevitably part of the Europe, so we are affected by whatever happens there. I mean, we don't have the euro. The Green Party wasn't in favour of having the euro because we think we're in favour of small currencies like the Bristol pound, so we can actually have some economic sovereignty over ourselves.
Which is being launched next week,
Wednesday,
by the way.
Yes.
In fact, I've got some notes on that. I should maybe say now.
I mean, we've got some really great policies like land value tax, which will tackle this issue of asset price inflation, because as we all know, asset prices have inflated massively, but relative to that, incomes have actually gone down. And in terms of household incomes, the only reason that household incomes have gone up over the last 20 years is because women have gone to work, and that has made, that has kept people's, you know, heads above water, is the entrance of women into the workplace, which could be a good thing. But it's just that, you know, as Simon said, there's a lot of the wealth is being redistributed.
Martin.
Okay.
Simon, that's the game, Simon says.
Yeah, so first of all, the Bristol Pound is here. This is the public event next Wednesday, 19th of September, from 5:30 until 9:30. Come and celebrate the launch of Bristol's own currency with a free evening of local festivities. Be the first to spend the Bristol Pounds at a unique Bristol Pound night market in the Old City. Meet over 20 of the Bristol Pound businesses and the Bristol Pound team. In fact, they've got this new little symbol for it, haven't they? The pound sign and then a large letter B. The Pound B team, a celebration of community and all things local. Now, quite exactly where that's taking place, I'm not absolutely sure. It says in the Old City.
I think it's Corn Street.
Up at Corn Street, near old St Nicholas Market, probably somewhere around that area. So I imagine if you go anywhere near, you'll be able to hear them from quite a way off, because artists include La Navette Bet, an international touring group, Troop of Clowns, Laurie Campbell, who's been living and performing around Bristol for years now, having spent the summer touring festivals, booking her for our launch before she heads off to an exciting tour around Finland, a unique voice and melodies, and finally Medicine Creek, a foot-stomping old-time string band from Bristol. So, Martin, what's your take on the Bristol Pound? Is it going to catch on?
Well, I think these kind of experiments are worthy and should be encouraged, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that we can stop a major meltdown in the mainstream financial system by such palliative measures. What we need, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation in the 90s, and what they used to argue in favour of is a multi-level system with an international currency, a national currency, local currency, which interacts in such a way that the maximum local autonomy is encouraged. But I'm still a socialist.
How would that work?
Of overall planning.
Are you talking about three different currencies circulating in Bristol, at the same time?
That would have been normal. That happens anyway. That's normal stuff.
Does it? I think there's only pounds, isn't
it? A currency is... If people are prepared to accept something, that is a currency. This is what people don't seem to realise, that money is actually quite a...
Are you talking about cigarettes circulating as currency?
For example. But I mean, the point is that anything that I pass to you and you can pass to a third person who's prepared to take it is potentially money. And money is not something that's fixed. It's actually a concept rather than a thing.
My father always used to tell a story about, he used to teach English for banking, about a man who walked into a bank with a cheque written on the side of a cow, and they had to accept it.
Well, if that was the rules in those days. Yeah. You try and do that today, they won't even accept ones on pieces of paper, never mind on a cow, you know.
Another story this week. UK banks could be shut down or forced into bailouts by Brussels. Sounds like scaremongering, but it isn't. This is from Wednesday, this story. A panel of European officials would be given sweeping new powers to police the financial sector across the continent, but also in the City of London. They would be given full decision-making powers to impose EU law and to arbitrate disputes between Britain and the Eurozone over the risk posed by British banks, according to proposals being tabled on Wednesday at the European Commission. Well, first of all, Martin, I find it a bit annoying and bizarre that all of these proposals seem to originate from the Commission and not from the elected MEPs. But first of all, how is this likely to affect things if the regulation of our banks is actually taking place in Brussels?
Well, you can imagine that the current cabinet is going to fight that tooth and nail. So it's a proposal; it's not necessarily going to be implemented. I think the fact of the matter is that the British City of London is the heart of darkness. They were actually doing all of this subprime mortgage stuff, which many things they were involved in New York wouldn't touch. And the rest of the world has a legitimate interest. If the City of London is going to be the big money market of the world, then everybody else in the world is going to want to have a say in how it's run. And do you know what? We'd be better off without it. And we should be like Finland or Norway, which hasn't got a big financial sector, and then nobody would be telling us what to do with our banks. But since our banks try to dominate the universe bites back.
Daniela, what's your thoughts about Europe regulating our banks? Because we haven't done it very well here in Britain, have we?
Well, no, I remember it was Gordon Brown who originally deregulated the banks and continued the neoliberal economic philosophy, which has led to such disasters. So, all much as I think that at least power should be closer to us, I think if any... definitely believe in regulation, particularly for the financial sector, and so I think it could be a good thing.
Well, also this week, dear David Cameron, this is from the wonderful, I just have to say, his fantastic blog, Ian Fraser is a financial analyst. Dear David Cameron, entrusting economic policy to ex-investment bankers is no solution. Well, he's being quite polite there, really, isn't he? This is the new reshuffled cabinet. When David Cameron reshuffled his cabinet last week, the arrival of a trio of City of London bankers and consultants at Her Majesty's Treasury went almost unnoticed. Three men are Paul Dayton, a former Goldman Sachs partner and chief operating officer for Europe, Sajid Javid, a former global head of credit trading at Deutsche Bank, and Greg Clark, a former consultant at Bolton Consulting Group. Cameron promoted Javid, who was first elected as a Conservative MP, to the Economic Secretary to the Treasury, and Clark, who's also been a Tory MP since 2005. The role of Financial Secretary to the Treasury most significantly, however, Cameron has appointed Dayton, who isn't even an elected politician, a Commercial Secretary to the Treasury.
Well, the phrase comes to mind, putting the fox in charge of the hen house, doesn't it? I mean, that is the reality of the situation. That's why nothing changes. Who pays for politics? Ah, it'll be the bankers and the hedge fund people. Why can't we change the policy? Ah, because he who pays the piper calls the tune. Where do they get their money? Ah, from quantitative easing, from the government. So we bail them out and then they tell us what to do. That's all wrong. If we're going to bail them out, we're going to tell them what to do. And if they don't like it, well, they ain't going to like it. We've got to break their political power.
Well, it's going to be
a serious issue, both in this country and in the US.
Having the consequences of these investment bankers, some would say financial criminals, inside the cabinet now that Cameron's newly appointed.
Well, it means that any sensible policy towards the financial sector is most unlikely to evolve until there is a crash. And do you know what? There may well be a crash. We haven't had a crash yet. When we have one, and people will realise in actual fact this is a disastrous policy, it's not just mildly out of line or misguided. We are now piling idiocy on complacency, on a pack of cards. And when this all goes south, as it will, people are finally going to wake up to the fact that having the financial services sector like this is just not worth it. We're better off without it.
Daniela, the other person that's not mentioned in this particular article by Ian Fraser is Lord Green, who's also a cabinet minister. He's never been elected by anybody, but he is the guy who was in charge of HSBC when they were laundering something like $20-30 billion for the Mexican drug cartels, and he was warned about it as well and did nothing about it. So, I mean, it does seem we've got some rather dubious characters right now sitting around managing our country.
Definitely. I mean, these people weren't elected. And just think on a day-to-day level, say you had a nurse who made an accident and accidentally injured somebody, they'd be thrown out on their ear. It's just one rule for those in power and one rule for the rest of us,
I think. It's not like an accident. It's like Stockholm syndrome by proxy. They're deliberately doing these things, not just making mistakes.
What is Stockholm syndrome? Would you enlighten us, please?
I think it's when nurses decide they're going to kill their patients. It's sort of Stockhausen syndrome by proxy, I think it's called, and occasionally nurses...
Munchausen syndrome by proxy, yes. That's very, very discredited, rather discredited theory, that one, about mothers destroying their babies deliberately.
Some nurses do go around and poison their patients, and many of the people in the financial services sector are criminals and have quite deliberately done what they've done. The idea that everybody's a nice person and it's only just due to people's misguided well intentions is just not the case.
I think there isn't the phrase expansionary fiscal contraction there, stock phrase. And if you just think about it for a minute, it just sounds so ridiculous that the fact that they could get away with announcing that as a policy is just
incredible.
I mean,
what they've done, Daniela, is they've thrown away the textbook I was trained on decades ago, and they've presumed that if they throw the textbook away, they can just make it up as they go along. Yeah. But life has a habit of coming back to bite you. And basically, it was obvious that if you carried through a policy of cuts, you were going to end up forcing the deficit up. But you see them all with like rabbits in the headlights going, oh, the deficit's going up. Now, that, in fact, is in the textbook. Now, of course, most people are not very economically literate. So the idea that if you cut government expenditure will go up, it's counterintuitive. Yes. Nevertheless, if you study economics at any serious level, the first thing you learn is that's how it works. And I can't understand why George Osborne is surprised that the deficit's going up. But I think this is what's going to be the killer for this government. Not that they are nasty in their social attitudes and vindictive, people can put up with that. They've put up with that for generations. But if the message begins to sink in that they are incompetent and they don't know what they're doing, that will be the finishing of them.
I would have an argument with the fact that your original economics textbook was actually right, and say that the original
about
economics,
this.
Okay, about this, but you know, disregards environmental goods, air, water, land, and just thinks of them, sure, as actually without any cost or value. So that's also what we're about in the Green Party, saying we need to get those precious non-renewable things into our economic system.
Well, one positive bit of news this week is the number of people out of work in the southwest, at least apparently positive, has fallen by 9,000. That was on ITV West on Tuesday. The number of people out of work in the region's gone down. 9,000 it's gone down, Martin.
Yes, and the deficit's going up. So in actual fact, they haven't cut the deficit, and because they haven't managed to cut the deficit, unemployment hasn't gone down as much as it might have done. So they've done good by accident, if you see what I'm driving at.
What about the Green Party's policy on this? Because I know you've got Martin talks on here quite a bit about this whole thing of the citizens' income being something quite helpful. What exactly is that policy, Daniela?
The citizens' income is one of our national policies, which said that everyone is entitled to a basic income as of right. So no matter who you were or what you did, you'd be entitled to a certain amount of money that would enable you to live. So you could be able, of course, if you wanted to have more money, you could work. That would also involve getting rid of all other benefits, so that it was just a fixed payment to everyone, so it would cut out a lot of bureaucracy. This would also enable people to look after their kids, not have to work, indulge in other activities, work part-time. So it would actually spread the workload out a lot more.
Martin, in the present climate, that is not political climate, I'm talking about economic climate, that's impossible. We just couldn't afford something like that.
No, in actual fact, it's one way to actually break the depression. If you give everybody an income, then you can actually kickstart the economy. And in actual fact, the Conservative government with IDS and his universal credit is in fact blundering with a blindfold on in exactly that direction. It was actually the citizens' income was originally thought up by Milton Friedman, would you believe? And he called it negative income tax. And the basic idea is that you give everybody a basic income, so you don't need any unemployment benefits or anything like that. It's all, and if you and you fund that through land value taxation, perhaps.
Yeah.
All of these things have been known about for years. The problem is not doing them. Partly it's to do with people not talking about it. We're talking about it now, but the mainstream doesn't talk about these things. And secondly, of course, the political power of the financial sector and the military industrial complex cancels everything, and that is the real problem we face. It's not coming up with good ideas. We pretty much know what to do. We can't do it because people are standing in the way and saying no, and that is the problem.
Well, one of the solutions that has been proffered anyway is allowing building of homes on the Greenbelt to kickstart the economy. So in the Daily Mail yesterday, we had build thousands of homes on the Greenbelt, says a think tank founded by the new planning minister. A study by the centre-right group Policy Exchange said that councils should be forced to free up vast swathes of countryside for house building in a bid to get the moribund market moving again. Well, leaving aside the problems with this particular group Policy Exchange, which a couple of years ago on Newsnight was exposed as forging receipts from Muslim mosques and bookshops, trying to show that they've been selling these extremist books, which they hadn't actually been. I mean, these receipts were actually just printed out on Policy Exchange's own inkjet printer and forged, basically. Other than the problems with this far-right think tank, Martin, do you think this, because you've actually been talking about house building as a really good way of kickstarting the economy, and that's what they're saying here.
Yeah, what we need to be doing is building social housing in the inner city, not building over the green belt for more yuppies to live. I mean, basically what they're talking about is trying to kickstart the private housing market. What we really need to do is reinvent the council house. Harold Macmillan built the most number of council houses when he was Prime Minister in the 1950s, Conservative Prime Minister. And what that does is it puts the homeless into homes, it puts building workers to work, and what it does is it stabilises the private house price.
But they're not talking about building yuppie homes. They're talking about building houses.
No, they're also saying get rid of the 606 planning regulations, which allow...
The 106 agreements.
Yeah, the 106 agreements, sorry. And they get, so in other words, what they're really talking about is a big bung to their mates in the housing industry.
Yeah, I mean, we do think there is a huge demand for housing in the inner cities, but there can be ways of fitting them into the inner cities, as you say, social housing.
Well, these houses are not for the poor. These houses won't go to those people.
Yeah, that's what we need. I mean, one of our other main policies for mayor is that we should, as a city, be raising money ourselves, independent of local government. We could create bonds and invest them in what we want. People of Bristol could invest in their own city. These bonds would go towards public transport, energy and possibly houses.
And
we might even
squeeze the pockets of the merchant venturers and see if they want to invest in Bristol a bit more than they already do. But one thing that has happened over the last couple of weeks with this whole house building business is large parts of the current Frenchay Hospital sites are going to be flattened over the next couple of years. And there was a heated meeting last week where I spoke to the chairman of the parish council up there, Tim Bowles from Frenchay.
I'm Tim Bowles, I'm Chairman of Winterbourne Parish Council. I'm here this evening to chair a public meeting so that all the residents of Frenchay and other people in the community can get together to discuss the draft concept statement regarding the future development of the Frenchay Hospital site.
Okay, well, what's being proposed?
At the moment, there's some draft proposals been made by the Hospital Trust that involve residential development of much of the site. It'll amount to hundreds and hundreds of new dwellings on the edge of Frenchay.
Is it just a case of NIMBYism? We don't want big new housing developments in our village?
I haven't heard that necessarily, no. A lot of people do recognise that Frenchay's got quite a broad mix of development, and you just have to walk around this remarkable village to see lots of different styles. So I don't think it's that. I think it's that people really do see this as going to have a very, very big effect on the long-term nature of the village and want to make sure that wherever possible their input can be heard.
Daniela, what are your thoughts about this then? Because it's a big hospital site. What they're doing is they're going to be flattening it, moving people over to Southmead and other places and building houses on it.
Yeah. Obviously, we do need houses, but there are different ways of doing these consultations and developments. There are good ways and bad ways. And I say what you need to do is get all the people involved from the beginning. You don't tell them, this is what we're doing and these are your choices. You go to local people and say, we need a certain amount of houses. Obviously, there's going to be infrastructure. What do you need in your area? What kind of parks would you like to see? How do you see this development going? And you start from the ground with the local people. Get them involved in designing it themselves. And they'll be only too happy. So they'll have brilliant ideas about how it should actually work out in the end.
Well, one definite opportunity are the vast numbers of empty offices we've got here in Bristol. And as I said a few weeks ago, Tony Crofts from the website, well, he's a Bristol resident, but he's also got a website, speaktruthtopower.net. He spoke to Alder King, the big estate agents, who said that there's 1.75 million square feet of empty offices within the area of the city of Bristol, which is the equivalent of the floor space of something like 75,000 homes. Martin, what can be done rather than flattening the hospital and building homes afresh, to turn some of these other brownfield sites, effectively empty offices, into homes?
The fundamental problem is the way the British economy has been run for a generation and more is based around property bubbles, which is why you end up with a massive oversupply of office space which nobody wants, which of course still goes onto the books of the people who own it as an asset. We've got people sleeping in the streets, and we haven't actually got enough affordable housing. This is the point. And if you create affordable housing, that has implications. During the council house revolution in the 1940s and 1950s, basically, the private housing sector was stabilised. House prices in Germany haven't risen appreciably in 40 years. In Britain, we get into this idea that house prices rising is a good thing. So you get on the ladder, and then, of course, you become part of the possessing classes, and eventually you will end up owning a little bit of Britain that's yours. Now, I'm not against people owning houses, but it shouldn't be a way to make money. People should basically make their money through thinking of good ideas, setting up businesses, going out to work. Everybody in Britain, the way we run it, it just creates all kinds of problems for us. So, for example, when the economy starts to pick up, house prices in the southeast start to rise, and then the brake has to be slammed on to stop the house price bubble going too far through the roof. And at that stage, of course, all the industry north of the Wash is already clobbered, because they need to actually carry on running the economy forward. And that is why Britain has been deindustrialised. We don't make widgets anymore, but we're very good on conservatories.
It certainly means that we spend more and more of our income, doesn't it, over the last 40 years on a roof over our heads. Daniela, what about this issue, though, about the empty offices, the 1.75 million square feet of empty offices, equivalent of something like 75,000 homes? Is there any way we can actually be building on some of these sites which are presently just empty, not being used?
I'd like to see them converted into flats where possible. As a mayor, We'd establish a planning notice to prohibit the construction of more office space if over 15% of office space in the area is already empty. So recognise that as a big issue.
Yeah, the reason it's empty often is because there is various different forms of business rate relief.
Yeah.
So an owner of a building like that is not necessarily paying what they should be in terms of rates, and maybe just simply getting rid of that might help. The only trouble there is that you would start to get a real market rent in offices. People would be having to pay much less for their office because there's a much greater supply. Then what that does is it reduces the value of these big properties, and sometimes can collapse a company because they like to have a high-value property on their balance sheet. Anyway, that's just my little bugbear, getting that one out of the way, my little soapbox. But we're joined now by Marina Morris, and she's talking friendship this week.
Hello. The role of friendship. Having no friends is as bad as smoking or being overweight. Quality of life comes not only from material wealth. We also have a human need to feel happy. The most recent World Value Survey in 2006 showed that 68% of Britons believe that friendship is very important. Compare these previous surveys in 1999 of 58% and in 1990 48%. An egalitarian society such as Sweden has a constant average around 71% through this period. Let's explore the benefits of friendship. The Nurses' Health Study by Harvard Medical School found that women with more friends were healthier as they age than those with less friends. The result was so significant that the researchers warned that having no friends is as bad for your health as smoking or being overweight. Research into how women cope after the death of their spouse found that women with a close friend or confidant were more likely to survive this experience without new health consequences than those widows without this support and outlet for the grief. Another study has found that people with the most friends had a 60% lower risk of death over a 9-year period than the subject with few or no friends. Conversely, the lack of friendship has a long-term cost. As we age or become too busy, friends, colleagues, family members disappear from our lives and we suffer an emotional hurt. We are social animals and friendship can improve our lives. Extrapolated statistical pattern promise and predict many practical health benefits through the strong link between friendship and health. There is also a link between a lack of friendship, stress, shorter lifespan, and depression. In our material world, we are free to make choices in life, but we are not free from the consequences. Can we afford to have no friends? And what do the people of Bristol think about friendship? Why is the role of friendship in the UK less important than in Sweden?
I think English people are a bit more reserved and a bit more insular. It makes the whole sort of nation get on a lot better. It makes the whole world a better place.
Because the UK is a very overcrowded island, and Sweden, people live a long way apart and they probably need 13% more friends there. People, and going back 50 or 60 years, because people were much more friendly then. They all lived in, a lot of them lived in terraced houses right next to each other and worked with each other and didn't all travel into Bristol to work, so they knew a lot more local people. 50 years ago, you know, the people in Kingswood would have worked at the factories in Kingswood and the people in Nailsea would have worked in Nailsea, and you haven't got the same sense of community, have you? You know, people get home from work and they're exhausted. They just shut the door and go to sleep, more or less.
You shouldn't believe statistics.
Maybe the people rely more in relationships more than friendship.
Maybe our television's better.
Essential.
Oh, it's absolutely essential. Yeah, it's one of the most important things in life.
Lifestyle, probably. Security, some love, I guess.
Who has a role in promoting friendship? Government, parents, teachers, peers?
I don't know so much about the government, definitely not. I don't know if we even believe what the government say about our country anyway. So I think it stems from the parents and the teachers, definitely. That's, I think, right. If it's not instilled in your child from birth, bringing them up, I don't think the government's going to sway it. So I think it starts with the parents and then goes on to teachers.
Well, it's certainly not government. We shouldn't expect government and the council to do everything for us. I mean, people organise their own things. I belong to a number of societies, you know, and that brings in friends. And it's just ordinary people can organise events and things like that that bring everyone together.
Everyone.
Parents. Less so the government. Parents, very important. Peers, probably second important. And then teachers, I'd say.
Parents, I'd say. For children to have friends, lots of friends. It's good.
From by yourself, I think.
Well, that was Marina Morris out on the streets asking you your thoughts about the importance or otherwise, and also why friendship, people seem to be less friendly. Do you think that's true, Daniela? One chap there was saying that in the old days people were more friendly.
Oh, I'm afraid I don't agree. I think I find people very friendly all over the place. I just, you know, could talk to anybody anywhere.
Martin, someone else was saying, well, the TV is so good, people haven't got time to go with their friends. Yeah, I mean, I would take issue with that personally.
That was a rather flippant remark, wasn't it? Well, I mean, basically, I find Bristol a very friendly place. I mean, I've lived here for 10 years now, and if you hang around long enough, you get to know everybody, and everybody gets to know everybody else, and sometimes people gossip about each other in a nasty way, but that can't be helped. That's part of the interaction. But the most successful cities are those which have what I think was called the strength of weak links. I don't know, I can't fix that, but I know a man who can, or a woman who can. And if you look at the northern Italian cities, which have been very successful economically, you've got lots and lots of small businesses, but lots and lots of chances for people to meet, to make contacts and networks. And those are networked cities where people have lots and lots of acquaintances rather than close friends are the most economically successful. There's a lot of studies that have suggested this is the case. And of course, friendship is very important. And ultimately, coming back to what Daniela was saying earlier, economics isn't just about gross national product or about just piling up material wealth. Ultimately, it's about well-being and welfare. And people.
Wasn't it the King of Bhutan that used to go on about gross national happiness, which is quite a different measure than GMP? What about, though, Danielle, are you saying you think people are just as friendly as they've ever been, but what about the effect of things like the pubs closing down, the community centres closing down, we've got also youth centres closing down, and we've got sort of drop-in centres for the disabled. A lot of those are closing at the moment. This kind of thing is bound to have an effect.
It will have an effect, and I think it's a really serious issue that we need our communal spaces. Those are the things that we value the most, particularly the pub, because I read a very interesting study of the English, how, you know, when you're in a pub, you are actually freed from some of your inbuilt English inhibitions to talk to people at the bar. And if you lose that space, that very precious space, the heart could drop out of a community. So we need to be fighting, especially, I don't know if you've seen, but Tesco seem to be taking over half the pubs in this region.
Well, there's just this week taking over another one in Portishead, and people are up in arms about that.
But and it's very hard to stop them, and that's where we need to actually, that's why it's important to have politicians who know that we have to change the rules on these things. That's the only way we're going to stop them.
But Martin, ultimately, is it possible to stop Tesco's taking over the pubs?
Well, I think leaving aside pubs, the other thing is local schools, where people all in an area take their children to the local schools. That is a very strong bonding experience. People who wouldn't otherwise talk, the children automatically make friends, and therefore people make friends through their children. But of course, if we've got a choice agenda where kids are being bussed from one side of the city to another and chasing some kind of academic ideal, supposedly, you're basically fragmenting communities.
But can you answer the question about the pubs? Because this is something we are seeing increasing. It's been in the news this week in Portishead too. Another pub has become a Tesco.
Well, the problem is Tesco's knocking out booze at a cut price rate. And don't forget, as the economy contracts and people have less money, they will go to Tesco's and buy a few cans rather than go to a pub. And that's clearly been hitting the pubs very hard.
But I mean, economically, is there anything you could do about it? Because there's not so much money for people to spend in the pubs. And there is a lot more money from Tesco's to build. They've got their big supermarkets, they've got all the world sort of covered with giant Tescos. They're now building these smaller ones, the Tesco Express ones, on what used to be the pubs.
Well, we need to regulate the economy to get the results we want. If you go to Norway, for example, I think it costs up to £5 for a pint of beer, but of course don't forget people's wages are double what we get paid here, and everybody's in a trade union and has got a job, so paying £5, and of course they do control drinking quite strongly, but it's a social event. You've got to decide what you want and then work backwards to see the regulations you would need to get.
So I think
we have a free-for-all in this country where cheap and cheerful is the only option.
Well, great pity. And, the big story of the week is the Hillsborough announcement. I mean, we had about a year ago on this programme, Tony Farrell, who was a senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police. So let's just refresh our memory as to what he said that he'd picked up from his colleagues at South Yorkshire Police about what really happened that day at Hillsborough.
It was at the time when the crush was starting and all hell was being let loose in the pen, where the gates had been opened and the crush had started and people were clearly distressed, and subsequently led to 96 people losing their lives. Now, Andy made his way to the control room as directed, and when he got to the control room, Andy said this is what happened. He tried to get in. Inside were police officers, and the police officers were very reluctant to let him in and told him to go away. Well, Andy sought advice from on high and was told to get in no uncertain terms and find out what on earth was going on. So ultimately, Andy managed to get inside the control room, and it was when he was inside the control room he realised why they were not prepared to let him in the first place. And the reason was this. Within the control room, where all the CCTV was unfolding and the horror of Hillsborough, while that was unfolding, the most senior officer on the day, which was an ACC, Walter Jackson, was in the control room, but he was underneath the table behaving like a gibbering wreck. So he was clearly distressed at what he was unfolding. And the reason why Andy wasn't allowed in was because the police officers were trying to protect his compromised position.
That was Tony Farrell there, former senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police, talking about his friend Andy, who was one of the public relations people at the time. Now, come to you first on this one, Daniela. This has really shattered for many people any kind of illusion about the police being really competent at that time. But not only that, there's a sort of double whammy. First of all, there was the cover-up, and secondly, there's still been no actual prosecutions for the people who were responsible for those decisions, or trials to see who might have been responsible that day. And it seems many of the people who were responsible for the cover-up and possibly for the disaster itself are still in their jobs.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that it's taken such a long time for the truth to actually come out. It's I'm really amazed about that. And there does need to be more research and actually proper trials, I'd agree, into that, because what happened was completely wrong, and well, they just covered up what they'd done wrong.
Well, one of the most serious things about it was that the panel has found that 164 statements were significantly amended and altered, with 116 of these having been negative or unfavourable comments about the police's action. Now, this is quite clearly, it looks certain on the face of it, Martin, to be a criminal offence, tampering, perverting the course of justice, very simply. The other thing is that there was access to the police national computer, probably criminal access to it, in order to try and find previous convictions of some of the fans, in order to divert the blame.
Well, yes, the whole demonising of the Liverpool fans, the rowdy Scousers and all the rest of it. But the South Yorkshire Police had already got form on that, of course, because they'd all grieve. They assaulted the miners' picket lines, injured loads of people, and then put hundreds of miners on trial for riot. And then the case collapsed because they were fabricating the evidence. And they showed at the trial that, in actual fact, the police attacked the miners then responded, and lots of people were injured, police and miners. But that was basically political from the top. And South Yorkshire have got a reputation for this kind of skullduggery, and frankly there's no place for it in a modern police force.
Will anything happen, do you think, now? Or will there be some proper
prosecution? I imagine there's a few people who are feeling pretty scared of the consequences of what may come from this. But I think also, we heard earlier about a guy gibbering wreck underneath a table or whatever. You've got to recognise that people, not necessarily nasty people, have just messed up here, and they're trying to cover it up. But I think what was really absolutely reprehensible was the Murdoch press attack on the Liverpool fans, which was all part of a kind of culture of blame for these so-called, feckless underclasses that we hear from the mainstream media all the time. The chavs have done this and the chavs have done that. It's a really negative stereotype.
Probably the most shocking part of all of this, other than this statement's being altered, and the more human side of it, Daniela, is this 41 people may have survived, we've since found.
Yeah, that is absolutely shocking, that the emergency services weren't there at the time, that just yeah, I can't really find it.
What about your thoughts about what this says about policing in Britain? I mean, we've heard many people, including the local MP, saying, "Well, this couldn't happen now."
Well, I'd hope it couldn't happen now. I just, with the new introduction of the elected police commissioners, that throws a whole new politicised dimension into the police force. Say something similar happened again. What pressures would that elected police commissioner bring to bear so that he didn't get chucked out of elected office? I think it's quite dangerous.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting angle on it, isn't it? It's strange, Martin, that as all this information is coming out about incompetence and possible, well, likely criminal behaviour by the police in South Yorkshire, that we are going over to a system where rather than having 10 or 15 heads looking and examining what the police are doing, we're going to have one as of November.
Well, as you know, I'm completely opposed to the election of police commissioners. I think it's a ridiculous idea. As I've said before, we spent 30 years in Northern Ireland trying to convince people that the police are above politics and they're not on anybody's side. So what do the nitwits in charge in London do? Oh, why don't we introduce an American idea of electing police chiefs? Try that in Belfast and see what happens. And if you think of that little thought experiment, you can see what might happen if there's another round of rioting. And the people in the inner cities have got one view, and the people in the suburbs have got another view, and we're going to turn the police into a political football. Fantastic.
Okay, our next story is to do with tax justice. I suppose back to the economics again, really, isn't it? And it's about whether people pay their taxes. And last week in town was the Tax Justice Bus, where I spoke to Alvin Musioma from the African Tax Justice Network.
My name is Alvin Musioma. I work for a network called Tax Justice Network Africa based in Nairobi. And I'm here with the Christian Aid Tax Justice Bus. We have been traveling through the southern Wales trying to raise awareness on the issue of tax and how tax dodging deprives the poor, both here in the UK and in Africa. For many years, our politicians have been playing lip service. It is high time that they put their money where their mouths are. The big problem is that the referees, those that determine the rules, are the major beneficiaries of that. The global financial architecture has been designed in a way that it deprives the poor countries the resources that they need for development. And we need to change this. We need to change this at national level, at the same time at global level. There are actions that the UK government can do that would ensure that UK multinational companies don't act in a manner that is undermining the broad policies of the UK. I find it, in my own opinion, a contradiction in policy that while on one side the UK government is providing aid, supporting revenue authorities in many African countries to be able to collect more, at the same time they turn a blind eye to the actions of British multinational companies that are practicing tax evasion and tax avoidance abroad.
What about the role of the UN though?
Well, I think that ideally the UN should be the platform where global legislation is done. But unfortunately, our efforts to have the UN Tax Committee strengthened has been undermined, more particularly by the rich club of nations, particularly the OECD, which has put all efforts to undermine our call to have the UN strengthened, particularly ensuring that it is elevated from a tax committee to a substantive body that would have to set rules that how global finance is governed. A few months ago, Kenya, the country I come from, invaded Somalia, and the reason they did that was to argue that the Al-Shabaab militia, which had been abducting tourists in hotels in Mombasa, was threatening the economic sovereignty of Kenya, and as that they used us as a basis to march into Somalia and try to uproot the Al-Shabaab there. The war is still ongoing, and a few months later there was a cartoon in one of our local dailies where they showed the Kenyan military air force bombing the island of Jazi. The argument at that particular time was that the four major scandals that had been uncovered in Kenya involving multi-billion shillings had direct links to Jazi. So the journalist was basically arguing and saying, if we can attack Somalia as and use economic sovereignty as a reason to attack Somalia, then we should be justified to raid Jazi because it is equally threatening the economic sovereignty of our country by providing the haven where these companies collude with our local elites to loot the state coffers. I work for an organization called Tax Justice Network Africa, and we are available at the www.taxjusticeafrica.net.
Okay, that was Alvin Mosioma. Daniela, what about this idea of the Kenyan Air Force coming over and bombing Jersey? I mean, it's a little bit extreme, isn't it?
It is a bit extreme, but I think the image is very valid. I mean, the money is being stolen by multinationals from African countries all the time, and that is relevant to this country as much as those. We have companies such as Boots, Vodafone, moving their headquarters abroad, avoiding millions of tax that, as people, as customers, we might shop in their shops, expect them to be paying their fair share, and they don't. Last year, Caroline Lucas, our MP, introduced a bill to the House of Commons to try and expose some of this, but of course it didn't go through, but it's something we're very keen to avoid. We're talking about cuts all the time, cuts and cuts. There's money there waiting to be taken back, our money.
Well, the Tax Justice Network, Martin, recently came out with a figure of $21 trillion in tax havens. Jersey's a very big part of that, isn't it? And as we've just heard, there is... their influence spreads to things like civil wars over in Africa.
Indeed, and then people say, well, we don't want the EU regulating our financial markets. Go away. Hang on a minute. Our financial markets, and of course, when you say Jersey, it's the City of London. It goes through Jersey on paper, as it were. But in actual fact, this is all done from London, just like the Cayman Islands. The money doesn't go to the Cayman Islands. It all circulates in the City of London. And in theory, it goes to the Cayman Islands. So Britain is right at the heart of tax evasion and financial skullduggery. And then we say, when anybody else says, well, we've got to do something about this, oh, well, it's our stuff, go away, leave us alone. Now, the City of London has dominated the global economy since the 16th century. And you can't do that and then expect to that everybody's going to ignore. I mean, Kenya was Britain's colony. We've got Kenyan people suing the British government for the tortures they were put through during the Mau Mau emergency in the 1950s. And recent studies from the US, and very serious studies, suggest that up to 200,000 people died in British detention in the 50s, and many of them were castrated and burned and electrocuted. And then, of course, we say, we don't owe anything to the Kenyans and they can just go to hell. Well, that kind of attitude is very prevalent and is going to cause all kinds of problems going forward.
Well, we had Leah McGrath-Goodman on the Kaiser Report on Russia Today this week, also going over to Jersey to do an investigation into the child abuse, the Hôte de la Garenne child abuse scandal, and then being arrested at Heathrow Airport, put in a dungeon underneath the airport, and then sent straight back to the United States. They talk on there about the jurisdiction here. The Queen could intervene, but she never does.
Indeed, and I mean, there are places like Luxembourg and Sweden where, Switzerland, not Sweden, where these kind of things go on. But Britain, in fact, is the biggest culprit for this kind of tax evasion. And David Cameron's father set up originally a Panama-based fund in the early days of liberalisation to avoid paying taxes in Britain.
Yeah, so he's not the guy who's going to change anything if his dad started it all, is he? He's not very unlikely.
Well, he might, if he's got any sense. He'll start talking about it.
Okay, well, anyway, we're coming up now, time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, the Green Party candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Daniela Radici. After the news, fracking in the Mendips, a wonderful new source of local natural gas, or a licence to poison Bristol's water supply.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are taking legal action.